When autumn rains come, and the ground rarely feels completely dry, and I'm
to be better podcast. We are actually not in our home studios today. We are live. Well, not live again. We are on location in my good friend Chris Balzer's studio. You know Chris Balzer as also the bike fit guru, but I've known him as my friend for a long time. I actually have tapped into his wisdom and his smarts many times, and I feel fortunate enough to call him one of my friends and fortunate enough to call him one of my work colleagues here. And today he has granted us his time sitting cross-legged like a good Zen Buddha he is in his chair here. Chris, welcome to Be Better Podcast.
Thanks, Chris.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing real well.
Yeah, it's, you know, we've known each other for maybe, 10 years now?
10 years, yep.
It's crazy that time has gone by. You've seen my kids grow up and see me when I didn't have kids and such. And you've been doing some incredible work. So just to kind of paint the background of where we're at, we're in your studio above your garage, which is not any normal garage. And from what I understand, you've done the vast majority of the finish work in here.
Yeah, I do my own remodeling.
And for those people that know, I am a craftsman too. I like doing woodworking. And this place is immaculate. I mean, we're talking immaculate. Everything is just perfectly done and perfectly finished. There is nothing that I would even consider to be unfinished in this room. So not only a great great brain, but an amazing craftsman. So I don't
fastidious.
Yeah, here we go. There we go. That's one of those words that
that's
I'll probably
a nice
look
way
up.
To say it.
That's
nice
one of those words
it.
I'll look up on Google after we're done here.
Yeah,
so Chris, people know you today as I would say one of the premier bike fitters in the nation. And but a lot of people don't know your backstory and how you kind of came to this point. And you weren't just born a great bike fitter and an amazingly fit person and a woke guy. You started off as an athlete. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So yeah. What was how did you kind of come into athletics?
I've always been, I guess genetically, I was a strong wrestler. You know, I won Tri-County first year. I was wrestling. My brother was a lot bigger. He used to beat me up a lot, which is why I think that came to be. But I was also really good in football. I was getting the college teams when I was a freshman. So always really, you know, didn't get sick, just a beast. And started riding bikes and was racing pro elite within a year and a half, 2 years. And
racing mountain bikes too,
racing
right?
mountain bikes, yeah. And I was a big runner. I was really wound up and had to get a lot of energy out, and I did it with athletics. And I loved mountain biking. I love anything on two wheels, motorcycles, mountain bikes, or actually I like anything that goes fast. So I did that for a while. And when I was doing it, I also was in a Big Brother program and worked with a kid, that I got into mountain biking and then started working with the Pedros New England mountain bike team to help with fitting. And I did some coaching stuff, real rudimentary stuff.
When, like, so what time frame is this?
80s.
Late 80s, okay.
Yeah, late 80s. And then this is in Connecticut. I was in Connecticut. I grew up in New York City, but I went to college in Connecticut and did a lot of riding in Mount Snow. That was my place, West Dover.
Nice.
Went to college to Pitt to get my MSW and then to go on to get a doctorate in psychiatric and alcohol epidemiology, which I didn't finish. But when I was there, I had a bike shop, Steel Mill Cycles, and I was doing fitting and selling custom bikes and had a knee injury and went to a doctor who told me that I would never run or race again because the chondromalacia in my knees was so severe.
Ooh.
And it didn't make sense to me. I looked at the body. I've always been really mechanically inclined, like working on motorcycles and stuff when I was young. And I knew that it was just a joint.
Yep.
And that if it's a joint, then it has muscles that move and it has compression and everything's supposed to operate a certain way. And I started researching that. I had access to the database at the university online, 2400 baud. There was no real, internet really wasn't happening, but I had the access to all the data. So I just started researching that instead of doing my doctor work, which wasn't great. But I was just fascinated with the body and how things moved. And I adjusted my position and made myself custom insoles with duct tape and adjusted my cleats. And my knee pain went away. And I continued racing and had a couple more good years.
Awesome.
Then I got Lyme disease, and I didn't know it. Ooh. And the reason it's important for me to bring that up is because I learned a lot of tricks about being efficient on a bicycle because I was still racing when I had Lyme disease. So,
interesting.
As my body was breaking down, I learned, for instance, not to use my brakes. And I learned how to get real small behind somebody when drafting and how to tolerate more pain and how to not look like I was dying. And you know, do things like I had a Chris King hub that was really loud and I'd chase people down hills and try to freak them out and then I could pass them or wait for the guy's heart monitor to start beeping and then go get on his wheel to make him blow up, you know. So a lot of psychological stuff. But I didn't know I had Lyme disease. I thought I was just getting older or I didn't know. So I started going to a number of different people to try to figure it out. I saw doctors, neurologists, physical therapists, chiropractors, and everybody said, we're going to be able to help you. And nobody did. And I spent about $150,000 getting prolotherapy, doing chiropractic twice a week, getting deep tissue work, body work, acupuncture, blah, 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 blah. Saw a neurologist who referred me to the Mayo Clinic to get a test for infectious disease, and they said that I showed no symptoms and that I was somaticizing, and so I said, okay, I'm crazy.
Crazy. They blamed it on you.
They blamed it on me. Whoa. And I said, okay, I'm crazy, and I'm cool with that. I'll just deal with this. So 2 years after that, I went to New York City back to see my family doctor who ran some tests on me, and they found that they did nerve conduction tests and found that I was, the left side of my body was severely demyelinated. And then in the process of trying to find the origin, they found that I had the Lyme disease. Okay. So I went through treatment for Lyme and blah, 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 blah. A couple years later, I'm left with the neurological disease and I'm in pain all the time.
How long between the time you were diagnosed and the time that you think you actually were infected did you live with Lyme disease?
It was 96 to 2008 before.
Holy,
I got diagnosed. Yeah.
Wow.
So
it had a chance to really have an impact on
it
you.
It got in there good. Yep.
Yikes.
And so the only reason that really matters, it's not like, you know, oh, poor me. It's, you know, I can't ride a bike more than like an hour without being in pain. And so how that helps me in my business is that when people come in, I am very conscious of their conditions.
Yep.
I am more concerned about them having a good outcome because I couldn't get it.
Do you think that the way that you were kind of shuffled around and not believed, that played into how you approach your practice and your craft now?
I think the not being believed at the Mayo Clinic, I don't really blame him for that. I think that I was seen by an intern, not actually a doctor, and he had me do some tests, and I passed them all, so that doesn't bother me. What bothers me is people telling me that they could help me that couldn't.
Oh.
And I see that as being a real problem in general today, is that there are a lot of promises. If you get these aero bars, you go this much faster.
Yeah.
If you get this wheel set, you're going to, you know, it's going to change your world. And I feel like if I pay for something, I should get it.
Yep.
Right? If you say to me, hey, you know what? I see you've got a weak glute medius muscle. I'm going to give you these exercises. We're going to get it taken care of. When I complete those exercises, it should be taken care of. If I do what you say, I should get the results that you have promised.
Exactly. And that overselling of service.
Yep.
Just for status. I mean, you see it in coaching a lot of times, and mm-hmm. I've seen that all too often. Like, oh, you should come to me. I can make you wicked fast.
Yep.
And then it doesn't happen. And then people say, well, why not? And like, well, it's all your fault.
Exactly. And that's the same thing with physical therapy or anything else, is that it's about compliance. They say, well, the patient was not compliant.
And that pushing of blame or responsibility off of the person who is basically being entrusted with something. That's systematic in so many different things.
Yeah, and
you know,
it really irks me. I mean, there are a few things that bother me as much as that.
Do you ever find? I mean, I'm sure at some point in time you went through the point where you started trying to call that stuff out. Like, come on, there's hypocrisy here, and how come this guy's saying this or this gal's saying this and can't do it and deliver it, and then you realize that this is making me look like sour grapes.
Well, you know what, I do call it out a little bit on the website. And I only do it in situations, I do it generally, and I do it in situations where it defies logic, where the research or something that somebody's doing defies logic. For instance, like IT band pain and cycling.
Mm-hmm.
The IT band pain and cycling, if you have IT band pain, it's typically because your glute medius isn't working well. And so the tensor fascia is trying to compensate for that. But when you're bent over on a bike, sitting down, the glute medius really doesn't have much function. Maybe under hard load, it helps stabilize the hip, but it really doesn't have much function. So you can strip your IT band all you want on the bike.
Mm-hmm.
And if the position isn't coordinated in a way that it's going to get that glute medius to fire instead of the TFL, it's never going to change.
Yep.
It's forever.
That makes sense.
And so things like that, I'll point out and do it pretty generally. But it's mostly because it's not that I'm trying to upset or argue with other professionals. It's because the client comes first. And if somebody's gone through 9 months of PT and still has symptoms only on the bike,
yep,
it's probably the bike.
And do you feel some level of responsibility to call some of those things out just because if you don't, nobody else will?
I don't know if anybody else will, but I feel obligated to do it for the clients that come in that... And I'm just using one situation, but when somebody comes in and they've been fit 3 or 4 times, or they've, you know, been seeing a body worker or a physical therapist for a long time and not had any results, and I'm like, well, didn't they look at you on the bike? And they say no. That's the kind of thing. I feel like educating the consumer to get a better service experience is what I feel obligated to do.
Yeah. Also, roll your eyes inside.
Yes.
Like very high. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, are you kidding me? This again.
Very much.
So you go through your diagnosis, you get there. And so it sounds like you were actually kind of working with bike fitting before that. At what time kind of spurred you to say, this is my passion, this is where I'm going to go? Because, I mean, you've got all this sports background, you've got a number of different, like, you know, pieces from your education that are kind of bringing you along. What drove you down this specific path?
I know it sounds kind of strange to say I was meant to do it, but I really, like, I was meant to do it. I see everything. Like, I walk into a room and I see the dirt on the, I see all the dirt. I see all the imperfections in the room. I look at a car. When I was a kid, I sold cars. And we'd go buy Corvettes, and I could look and see all the problems with the car. I could identify them. I worked on a boat, and I knew everything had to be just perfect. I had a Navy SEAL boss who was actually a really nice guy. You'd think, you know, Navy SEAL boss, he's kind of a... but he wasn't. He was super nice. And so super meticulous to attention to detail and seeing everything. And also a little ADD, so my mind, but in a good way.
Yep.
Because I think of a lot of different things at the same time. So when I look at a person's body on a bike, it's a puzzle to me. Because different people with the same symptom will not respond the same to an intervention. So if somebody has right hip drop and I try to put a shim under that right hip drop, it may actually square their hips out, or it may create joint compression.
Interesting. Yep, that makes sense.
And so I have to be able to see that, and that makes it fascinating to me, is that, you know, what are we going to do today? And when I look at a person, I don't use much technology anymore. I did, as you know, we did 3D stuff in here and EMG and all that. And I've written 3D integrated 3D and EMG programs for bike fit. But what happens with technology is that it misses all of the different wrinkles in the skin. It misses the discoloration in the hands or the elbows, just demonstrating the pressure on the pads. It doesn't let me know whether the person's happy.
Yep.
Or not. It doesn't tell me cadence changes. It doesn't tell me how something sounds. And so all of those things make it a very, very, almost like a meditative experience. I mean, when I'm with a client, I don't want anybody around. I'm focused on them. We go deep. And it isn't just deep bike fit. It's deep. There's a connection between us. And it's not a phony connection. I'm not like trying to win their trust. I'm genuinely interested in people, so I get to know them. I look at them on the bike. I can see where the problems are, and I just play around with it until we get it right.
There's a lot of parallels there that you just kind of outlined. I think between, you know, people have, I think, for a long time tried to figure out how to make us, you know, where's the scalability on bike fitting? You know, how do we package what you do and then just kind of send it out so people can kind of plug and play and do it? And the same thing can be said for coaching. You know, how do we try and scale out what you do, put it into an app, you know, an app, and then, you know, then have 100 people, you know, be coached by you? Like, how can you fit like 50 people in one day? Well, you really can't. there really is something to be said for the humanization and the one-on-one contact and relationship and the time that you invest into the individual you're working with. That makes what you do kind of, I don't think you could really replicate that with AI. I mean, you could come up with some of the ideas of it, but you will always have to have the human contact, the human, I would say, interaction or intuition to see things that are not commonly seen by anything else.
Yep.
And that goes, I think, with what you do, and it also is the same with what I do. And, you know, in coaching, that you could try and say, okay, well, you could do a static program, but you have to be able to hear and see what the person's doing and then react to what they're doing. Because if you don't, I think that's the secret sauce. And, you know, when someone is fit by you, and I know that the process isn't like a 15-minute process. It's not like when someone goes to, you know, like goes to a bike store and buys a bike and they pull it down, they put it on a trainer. Okay, here you go. You're out the door and fit. Like it's not really like that. That's like that's a basic fit, but that's not a fit. That's not a sport fit. That's not going to the root thing. And there is something to be said for that. And I think that's one of the things when I recommend people to you, when I recommend athletes to you from either professional athletes that have never met you before or, you know, age group athletes that are just getting into a bike, I often will use a disclaimer that it's a multi-touch process. That many times what I've always recognized in you is that you see where the end product should be, but don't put somebody right there. That there is an acclimation that needs to happen, especially physiologically, to a position. People have to acclimate to that. Otherwise, I mean, you know, they're going to walk out the door and they're just going to raise their seat up. Like really, you spent all this money to have me look at you, spend time with you, and then you went out and just like put salt in the soup.
Yeah.
Like, whoa. Like that's got to be super, super frustrating for you.
Well, I think, you know, if there's not to disclose too much about the secret of my success, but a lot of it comes from, I used to teach yoga, and I taught really hard yoga. I was an Ashtanga teacher, and Ashtanga is hard. And I would go at my practice with an objective, and the objective was always to be able to demonstrate or do the posture in its final form, because that's the way it looks.
Yeah.
And I went and did a teacher training. I had multiple teacher trainings, and I went out to California to do teacher training in a place called Ananda, and it was gentle yoga. Now, gentle yoga is not macho, it wasn't macho. And so I whipped out like my Wicked Warrior Ashtanga one, and they said, no, you're going to do this Warrior one. And it was very, like all the postures were super moderate, like no strain, no pain, eyes closed, thinking happy thoughts. And I just thought it was fluffy. Anyway, I came back from that for a month, and I could do the intermediate series of Ashtanga, which is hard. I mean, it's a hard. I'd never been able to do it before. And I, really excited, I called the person who did the training and I said, I just did the intermediate series. What happened? And she said, well, that's probably the only time you'll be able to do it, because you've reintroduced your aggressive mindset to your practice and your body doesn't like it. She said, what happened? The reason you could do it is because you taught your body you weren't going to hurt it for a month. And what I took from that in my teaching intro, beginning Ashtanga, is that I needed to help people find a place where they could be, because if they could be, they would release and get more. And it's the same thing with bike fitting.
Yeah.
Same thing Steve Head said. Steve Head said, you know, you can either be forced into an aero position or you can let a body relax into an aero position. If I take a person and I slam them, they will be slammed and nothing will change because their body's in a constant state of tension, and tension doesn't change when there's tension.
Correct.
But if I take a person, put them into a position where they can relax, the deep stabilizers, the spine gets stronger, their pelvis relaxes, their low back becomes more flexible so they can endure a lower position with the same good range of motion at the top of the pedal stroke that they need.
Yep.
And they'll develop a strong body that will beg for a lower position. I mean, I've had some people drop 5 to 10 centimeters between the original fit and the follow-up because I didn't slam them right off the bat. So I think that the progressive nature of it, that the progressive nature is that, and it all started when I sponsored people in 2010. I have the 3D EMG system, and I wanted to start doing research. So I sponsored a bunch of triathletes and ran trials on them and fit them. And because they were reflecting my work, I was really sure that I had to make their positions perfect, so I would. And one by one, they were supposed to come back each month, and one by one, they came into my studio, and their positions looked horrible. 1 month after I'd fit them. And I couldn't believe it. I'm like, oh my gosh, what did you do to your bike? And they said, I haven't touched it. And the only thing that I could come up with is their body had relaxed. And so the saddles looked too low, the handlebars looked too high and too close. And one by one, the saddles went up, bars went down, bars went out. And it took 2 to 3 visits for their bodies to stop. And that was a really effective position for them, because then they were comfortable and aero and fast versus being slammed into a position that their body couldn't accommodate or acclimate to, or, you know.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Do you think that that's a big, do you think that's a common belief that's accepted across the industry in bike fitting, or do you think that it's kind of an anomaly with you and a couple people?
It's an anomaly for me, but I mean, I fit 900 people last year, so it works, right? I mean, it's got to be working.
If it does, if people aren't doing it, why wouldn't they be doing it? Why wouldn't somebody?
Because it's not profit. It's not as profitable.
Makes sense.
I could make $500,000 a year if all I did was put people on size cycles and give them numbers, because it would take me 20 minutes. A size cycle fit, 20 minutes. Size cycles don't move. There's no sway. So I can adjust you. Everybody loves it. Like on a fit bike, size cycle, I can get you into a position that you will love more than anything you will ever experience on a regular bike, because it doesn't sway. And I find the balance point, and then poof. So people tend to be in a lower, longer position or sitting completely upright. One of the two. But that's where if I was just in for the money, I'd just have people come and I'd do their size cycle fitting and give them their numbers and say, go get it set up at a shop and leave everything else up to that. But in my experience, I have only once done a size cycle fitting that translated directly into that person's riding experience. Because I always get the bikes back. I do size cycle pre-fit. They go buy the bike. They bring it back. I've got Ambrose at Now Bikes. He sets it up perfectly. He's the guy I use the most is Now Bikes in St. Paul. Sets it up perfectly. And they come back in. They sit on the bike. I'm like, nope, that's not right. We change things around. Centimeter two, bars.
There's still some movement there.
Always.
That makes sense. I mean, because you're sitting on two different bikes.
And I
think that's probably something that a lot of people don't understand.
Yep.
Do you think that you could ever fit yourself, or is that a process that you would have to entrust somebody else to do?
I entrust somebody else to do it, because I can't see my back. I can't see my butt from behind. I tried once with video cameras, but everything's backwards, so it's hard to see. It's hard to get it. And besides,
do you think you would trust yourself that to see through the same lens? Much like doctors don't self-diagnose, or at least they're recommended not to. And I've tried self-coaching and I suck at it. Do you think that's something that you just have to entrust somebody else to be able to see?
I do. I've got a guy down in Texas, Jerry Gerlich. I use him for my fitting. I go down and see him. He sets me up. And ultimately, the irony is that, you know, I mean, I've got the problems that I've got, but most of my stuff is like, it's not the fit, it's me. And I think that's something else that people have a hard time getting around. It's like, my bike fits me well. I don't ride a bike well because I've got the neurological problem. And I see that a lot with people that people have physical issues. You know, if you have a hip issue,
yep,
I'm not going to put you in a position where you can't get over the top of the pedal stroke.
That's very interesting. I see where it all comes back again to how we were talking about blame. And we had a conversation about that kind of offline here a little bit about how people don't want to take responsibility for it, but they'll blame the fit as being why they're not doing something right. And they'll tweak with that when it's actually, it might be something with themselves.
Exactly.
And that's an interesting perspective. And I don't know that people see that all that often. Where do you see the craft of bike fitting going? Where are the things that are still out there to be done? Or is it kind of just, is everything being done that can be done? Do you see some unknowns out there? Like, where do you go to kind of push yourself?
I think we're just scratching the surface with bike fit. The biggest issue that I've been studying primate function lately, because I think because it's very interesting to me how different we are from our, if you believe in evolution, from primates.
Or I'm a flat earther, so that's okay.
So even if we're just to say, let's just look at the difference between our anatomy and a monkey's or ape's anatomy.
Yeah.
And like, we have glute medius muscles on either side of our body to help stabilize our hips for an upright position. We have lumbar lordosis. Humans are the only species that have lumbar lordosis. because we stand upright.
Yep.
Everything about us is to stand upright. We're not meant to ride a bike. And so when I study this stuff, I look at it and I say, okay, well, apes or primates had very large hamstrings.
Yep.
Because they were bent over. It helped keep their pelvis from dropping. They had huge glute medius muscles as hip extensors because their legs were never fully straight.
Okay.
And they don't have to stand upright. So I look at that kind of stuff and I say, wow, man, you know, why am I using medical knowledge for bipedal human activity on bikes or bike fitting? So that, to me, is fascinating.
Yeah.
The stuff that people like Steve Hogg's doing low velocity manipulation on people's bodies and getting them to change the way their body sits on a bike by making small adjustments to their body versus using shims and wedging. So if you can change a person's structure quickly and effectively, that's pretty powerful. I don't know how to do that stuff, but I think that there's something there, and I think it's definitely, you know, I judge it by the outcomes. These guys are having people, he's creating good outcomes, which means, in my opinion, that it's a good system or it's a good approach or it has merit. There's not enough research on bike fit, and the research that was done is either old or slightly flawed. I mean, the knee over pedal spindle thing is not accurate at all. Perfect example. Like we thought that having your knee over pedal spindle at a certain angle, joint angle, would make all the difference in the world. But the fact is, your ankle angle can impact the muscle recruitment. If you drive with your heel more, you're going to use more posterior muscles. If you point with your toe, you're going to use anterior muscles. So the whole knee over pedal spindle was to stop tibiofemoral compression, when in fact, if the quadriceps are the only thing attaching the kneecap to the tibia, making that compression, why don't I just use more posterior muscles? And that's not to say it's right, but it's to say that we really don't know. I mean, we're just scratching the surface. What I can tell you is in the bike fitting world is that it is harder and harder to start your business and become successful like me because there's a lot more competition. I started before there was a whole lot of competition.
Yep.
People are attracted to technology. They're attracted to who you fit. Did you fit a professional rider? Do you fit a lot of pros? The pro cyclists I work with, they don't need a whole lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit here, a little bit there, maybe insoles, blah, 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 blah. It's like what I want, the person who I respect is the person who can fix someone who is been in a car accident and wants to be able to get back on a bike and they can't.
Has issues. Yep.
And that's where I think that bike fitting can evolve is that kind of a thinking where it isn't just, these are your joint angles.
Yep.
Here's my video analysis. We have to move past that. And it has to become more of it has to be more of a hands-on in life, touching experience.
It's a craft.
It is a craft. There's a lot of art in it.
Yeah, and much like how woodworking is, there's you have to see something, understand it. You have to be able to see what you want to do before you start. And then there's a lot of parallels there between, you know, just between like woodworking and bike fitting.
Coping.
Yeah.
Right? You want to use decorative trim. You have to get the inside edge.
How is it supposed to work? And you have to be able to see it before it's done to be able to find the path. It's a lot of reverse engineering inside your head and figuring out what's the best way to get that out of it. And then when you're working with a human, there's a whole different factor because, you know, wood's just stationary. I mean, wood can be predictable in how it's going to react. You know, it's going to bend and how it dries, what are the properties of it. But how are humans going to react to, like, well, we may not give you the immediate result that you want, but it's going to come. We have to be patient with it. So just like, I mean, much like coaching, I think when people look for coaches, they say, well, especially let's say you have somebody who's a high-end elite, and looking for a coach, and they will ask you, well, how many pros have you worked with? Well, it's like, I've worked with a handful of pros, but I've worked with a number of people who have never done an event before and have come off the couch and have gone to become active. Yeah. And you think about the progress that's made there, much, much the same. And unfortunately, the priority or the glamour is on the person who only works with the best of the best.
Yep.
And it's easy to kind of, you know, to work with somebody that once somebody's a pro, they're kind of on cruise control and it's managing different things. And much like prescribing swim, bike, run, it's a formula. The secret sauce is in seeing the person, understanding the person and getting to know the subtleties of it.
Yeah. I mean, I could be a lot more successful. I could work with more professionals. If I wanted to be just like the pro try guy, I would go to Ken Enfield, get a fifth certification, get him to promote me, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But I don't want to. I want to work with people. Like, I like working with, like, what you just said. I want to help people enjoy the sport.
Yeah, because who would have ever thought that the, like, you know, being a high-end bike fitter, where are you going to do that? Minnesota.
I know, but we have some great cyclists.
Oh, we do. Like, I mean, we do push them out. And the fact that there's, like, so many different, like, I would say bike sports that are being evolved. You know, you think about the evolution of gravel and the modification for, you know, for mountain biking and downhilling and fat biking. We are kind of the epicenter for a lot of that, which is pretty neat. One question I really wanted to get your opinion on, and it's kind of a hot topic lately in triathlon, is the movement of the cleat on the shoe from under the ball of the foot to the center of the foot. And there's been some writing on how that can alleviate some strain in the calf muscles, especially in longer distance events. There are installation issues, you know, trying to put a speed play cleat onto the middle of a shoe, cycling shoe, sometimes can be hard to even like fathom how you're going to attach that. From your standpoint, have you looked at this before? Have you thought about it, and do you have an opinion on it?
Yeah. So the midfoot cleat placement is interesting because there's a guy who I cannot remember his name, but I can forward his research. He did research on the midfoot cleat placement because mostly not because of the gastroc soleus complex, but because of the glutes. He saw that a more posterior cleat placement recruited glutes. I looked at that and said, well, that makes sense. I mean, if you're going to do a squat on the balls of your feet, it's harder than doing it on your heels.
Mm-hmm.
So with triathletes, I typically move the cleats all the way back, right out of the box. Yep. And the reason is it opens up the ankle joint, the knee joint, and the hip joint. So, safer. The midfoot cleat thing is tricky because there's a patent on it. In Europe, there's a guy who owns a patent on it, which is why shoes don't do it.
Really?
You can buy custom shoes with midfoot cleat placement, but you can't get... That's why Shimano doesn't have a midfoot cleat placement shoe. If they did, people would probably buy it. The problem with midfoot cleat placement is getting the cleat to exist in the same plane that it would on the forefoot. So the shoe is not flat. A shoe isn't flat from tip to heel. If it was a board, you could put the cleat anywhere you want, but it's not. There's an arch, which is typically inverted. So it's got the arch. If you were to put a cleat on that, it would make your foot invert when you're riding.
It would sit wrong, meaning if you're sitting the shoe on the ground and you look at it from the side, it's not flat.
It's not flat. So what we do is, what my buddy Jerry Gerlich does, I've got some midfoots in the house that I tried out that I like, is he takes he'll tape a small digital level to the heel of the shoe when it's in the forefoot clipped position, and then when he's making the midfoot cleat, he'll wedge it, he'll put wedges and shims and stuff underneath the cleat until the heel position is equal to where it was at the forefoot.
Hmm.
So it's good, but it's still a hack. You want to get it done, you should get it done custom shoes. My personal opinion is this. We have a gastroc soleus complex. The soleus is one of the best vasoconstrictors we have. It moves blood away from the feet back to the heart. That action comes from ankling. When you go midfoot cleat position, you are still having to bring the foot to the top of the pedal stroke. It's still the same height.
Yep.
So slightly lower because the distance between your forefoot and heel, but it's still an issue. And the problem with the top of the pedal stroke is the top of the pedal stroke. If you measure the distance from the bottom bracket to the top of the pedal at the bottom of the pedal stroke, the distance is shorter than it is at the top. Because at the top, the axle is between the bottom bracket and the pedal body.
Yep.
So my suggestion is shorter cranks. I prefer shorter cranks because shorter cranks allow you all the benefits of a midfoot cleat placement, and the cleats are still all the way back on the shoe. They have all the advantages of the midfoot cleat placement, but they also open up the hip, and as a function of that hip being more open, they reduce quadratus lumborum recruitment, which is involved in respiration.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore help reduce inspiratory muscle fatigue when running, which is a thing.
Absolutely.
So that's one component. The second component is there's a lot of research, Jim Martin's studies out of the University of Utah that show that there's no power loss with shorter cranks. Now, I don't think there are power gains. I know some people get power gains, but most not. But the foot velocity is slower. Even at a higher cadence with shorter cranks, typically going from 172 125 to 155. If you do the math, foot velocity, 10 RPMs faster with the shorter crank still does not have the same foot velocity as the larger cranks, and foot velocity is what makes us cardiac output.
Yep.
So the foot's moving, the legs are moving quicker, which we know there's also inertia. There's an inertia component to that, so they're moving quicker.
Yep.
We're running a higher cadence. We're being efficient. And when you get off the bike, you run better. One thing I can say about the shorter cranks, I think 90% of the people that I have fit with shorter cranks run better off the bikes. So you don't have to rip your shoes apart.
Yep.
You don't have to worry about whether or not everything's aligned. You don't have to worry about them breaking, because when you do drill out the shoes, they're not designed to be drilled there. Like the midfoot cleat isn't drilled. You have to make sure that you've drilled them in a way that you can still rotate the cleat effectively,
yep,
depending on the cleat you're using.
There is an issue also of moving the foot so far forward beyond what maybe be industry design that the foot could hit the wheel as it turns if it's in that 3 o'clock position.
Well,
where
with big feet like me, yeah.
Yeah.
But the front center distance, so the distance from the bottom bracket to the front axle, front center, isn't usually going to be an issue, isn't typically, with tri bikes, it's not typically an issue with that. Smaller bikes, yep, yes. But more importantly, and the only thing so there are two components to the midfoot cleat position one of them is that we lose some of the coordination coming over the top of the pedal stroke.
Okay.
Because we use our ankles to help us get over the top. We use our ankles to coordinate that.
Yep.
If you're good at getting over the top of the pedal stroke, you actually drop your heel at the right time and it accelerates the crank past top dead center rather than stalling into it, the radial load in the crank. So that's one. The other is that when you move the cleat very close to the heel, you lose the ankle's ability to compensate for pelvic imbalances caused by muscle or bone inequality between the legs. If my right leg is tighter than my right hamstring is tighter than my left, my right leg will not extend naturally as much as my left when I'm pedaling. Now the ankle on the right leg compensates for that. It's a mobile adapter.
Yep.
So it will typically point more. Right?
Yep.
So if I'm pointing more on my right than my left, and I take that out by moving the cleats towards my heel, then my problem becomes more apparent.
Interesting. That's I think all of that is not really something that most athletes would take into account.
No, because they read it.
They're chasing after the new shiny dime.
They read it's good. And somebody might do a study somewhere where it shows something, but the study is a snapshot of time,
yep,
in time. And it could be, like, one of the problems that I have with research and studies is that, in my experience, if I put a person into different muscle tissue, they might ride better. They might perform better, especially if they're highly trained athletes, because they're always on the edge of going too far with their, you know, like, I'm tired from using these muscles. Put me in some new muscles. Oh, my gosh, I'm so strong.
Yep.
Well, those muscles aren't conditioned to be strong yet. Or maybe there's some implications of using those muscles that you won't know for a while.
Yeah. So two follow-up questions on this. Number one, in the modification of foot velocity in the same RPMs going from, let's say, 172.5 to 155, would you then think, my brain would say then the optimal RPMs that would, or cadence that would want to be held would want to be up higher. So instead of having, saying, an optimal cadence of like between 85 and 90, moving it to, say, 95, 100 might be just that adaptation if somebody is moving to a smaller crank. Would you think that's...
Absolutely. And they don't have to try to run a higher cadence. Most people run a higher cadence with shorter cranks regardless. And the best way to tell is if you have somebody sit on a bike and have them pedal backwards. Now, it's not the same because you're using the exact opposite muscles. But typically, one hip is harder to get over the top than the other.
Yep.
Which means that the opposing leg's working harder. So if my right leg looks strong, it may be because I have a tight left hip.
Okay.
Right? So, and this comes down to the aero thing. Like, there's a lot of research that says aerodynamics over power. If you can get a person low enough, it doesn't matter if they lose 20, 25% of their power because they can go faster aerodynamically.
Yep.
But what they don't look at it is why are they losing power? And they're losing power because you've exceeded the functional hip rope movement. The range of motion's done.
Yes.
They're losing power because the working leg is trying to get the non-working leg over the top of the pedal stroke where there's not enough room at the hip joint to,
yep,
do that. So when you go shorter cranks, it's more exponential. It the the impact it has on a body is more than just the difference in crank length. So if you put 132 to 155, you'd say, okay, well, I got to raise them X amount of millimeters, right?
Yep.
But it doesn't work that way. Typically, they have to go up higher or more or further back. I don't usually drop the front end with shorter cranks. A lot of people do. They say, oh, shorter, you can go lower in the front. But you're already changing that dynamic by raising the saddle with the shorter cranks.
Yeah.
I don't see any negative impact from doing that. I haven't had to put shorter cranks on and raise the front end ever.
Huh. Interesting.
Very interesting.
And I've worked with you. You've put shorter cranks on a number of my clients that I work with, and I've seen, and we actually did a little bit of kind of soft testing at one point in time, mm-hmm. about a year and a half ago on this, and I had seen that we were able to actually get people back to their same FTP within 4 weeks, yep. in that adjustment. And a lot of it is mental. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing that we haven't touched on here that I have always thought about in the advantage of moving to 155 cranks, and this is not, and if you're thinking about the original question was, does moving the cleat placement to the center of the shoe, does that make a benefit? Should we chase that dog down? And with your response that you were going to really get the same thing from moving to shorter cranks, what you're not getting from cleat placement is any aerodynamic increased aerodynamic drag. Like we're not decreasing that number at all. Versus mm-hmm. smaller cranks, if you think about one of the biggest drag factors or causes of drag on a bike is the movement of the legs.
Movement of legs and trunk angles. So when you go shorter legs, you're actually raising the butt, which is making them more aero.
And the feet are actually having a smaller mm-hmm. distance of travel. Therefore, there's less movement of the legs, yep. and therefore less reduction in the creation of aerodynamic drag, mm-hmm. which I think is the big thing that people don't see. Just having the lead, it would almost be like putting somebody in a wind tunnel with their legs moving versus their legs stationary. There's yep. two different drag factors there. Yep. And that's where I see one of those biggest things. If you can keep the power to be same, but now we're reducing drag factor, now it's a win.
Yeah.
Like that's the win right there. So, and then if there is a benefit on the run off after that, I mean, that's icing on the cake right there.
Yeah, it's totally icing on the cake. And I don't know, I haven't studied, I believe that midfoot cleat placement probably has similar impacts on the run, and I'm not opposed to it. I think it's a good thing. I just think that it involves a lot more, anytime you modify a piece of componentry,
yeah.
you're it's not designed to be used that way. I don't know that it should be used that way. Like, no. I mean, if every shoe has a special spot of it that's designed, the engineers are thinking, we're going to do it this way.
Yep.
And then you say, I'm going to do it this way. I don't know. You know, I mean,
it seems to be too many things that we have to try and too many yep. bridges we have to cross there.
Yep.
And I mean, it's from a tinkering standpoint, it's pretty cool. We get to mess with some stuff,
yeah.
But you know, I think it's easier just to go and to see where the physiology and the aerodynamics come from with just shorter cranks.
Oh, yeah.
Now, because we only have a couple more minutes, I want to just touch on a couple things that I just recently learned on, and I'm not sure if you've seen this, but, in paratriathlon, the movement of, for athletes that are amputee above the knee, moving them away from cycling with their prosthetic to the use of what's commonly referred to as a stump cup. Have you seen how that's being used by so I think the first athlete that I saw that was using it was Mark Barr, mm-hmm. gold medalist in Rio, male yep. paratriathlete, is using this stump cup, which is essentially saying I'm only going to have 1 foot pedaling, and I'm now recruiting almost in just right at the saddle of where the leg is. Have you seen that happen yet?
I have seen it. I don't know enough about it to speak to it. I have not looked at, so I typically, I haven't looked at the EMG work on it. I haven't seen how the muscles recruit with that. I almost think that if they had a stuff cup, if it had a little bit of movement, it would help, because we're designed to move
yep.
both sides of us. You know, that's how we're designed to walk. We don't yeah. just walk. If we had a peg leg, we'd be limping, right? So I don't know that a prosthetic's smart. I don't know if that's smart, but I'm sure the people that did it have done some of these studies and found that it works.
Yeah. It was interesting to see, because I had not seen it before. The first time I saw it was when I was out at the Olympic Training Center this last time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, knowing that, I mean, right now, if you look at it, it's a big clunky piece of like carbon that's attached to the seat post, attached yep. to the top post. And it's, you know, these are like kids at college printing them off on 3D printers right now that are making these. And it's interesting when you think about how, you know, there's multi facets to the benefit of it. Number one is, you know, it's one less thing to worry about. So you don't have the pre-transition change or putting on a prosthetic. Yep. You now can just crutch it all over there without having to attach a prosthetic. Then detach that, which normally the paratriathletes will do before they go on the run. It's like kind of a speeding up of movement. It's almost like going from like tying your shoes to speed laces, but also cutting weight. So now you don't have that the weight of that prosthetic leg exactly. on the bike. You're lighter, and therefore your power to weight, you know, ratio just can go up almost immediately from right there.
And I would think that it offers a form of stability for the pelvis too, so that it can drive more through the working leg. My problem is that I always think in terms of symmetry.
Yeah.
And so I would have to think asymmetry. Like, you know, Kristen Armstrong, she did not ride a bike symmetrically. Her saddle was turned to the left. She actually twisted her head and used mostly her right glute to pedal.
Yeah,
that's because she was that's what she had to do.
Yep.
And so, like, if you don't have a leg, I'm probably not the right guy to say whether or not it's going to work, because I'm like, oh, I want this to be this way.
Yeah,
well, I'd have to rethink it, but I think that's super smart.
Yeah, because there's no symmetry, even if you do have a prosthetic.
Yeah.
But there's not, if you think about if you're like a Melissa Stockwell, you know, where she is, you know, she does not drive a lot of power from that leg.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it's just kind of there. So if you were to look at like a spin scan analysis, you would not see, it would not be there. So just the elimination of it, and I do see like the adaptation to it, the balance, getting on and off the bike, having it go in and out. But it's interesting to see if that were to be modified where there was a little bit of sway, even if it was on like a little bit of a flex hinge.
Yeah, like a little carbon hinge or something.
That it could rock back and forth. This is one of the things that Paratri really like blows my mind and really drives me there, because there's so many of these new things that can be found. Because like with Mark, he is, he is a right leg amputee. Mm-hmm. So, what we're looking at is moving to put the drivetrain only on the left side. So putting, you know, taking off even just the crank arm, much like how the women's track cyclist did, and how like, oh wow, that let's move it all over to that side.
Smart.
And now, but you know, there's a lot of pieces to that puzzle. You know, you got to move redo the hub, you know,
drive. You got to redo the derailleur and everything.
But it's like, it I don't want to say it's the wild, wild west, but it is like, there's so many like cool opportunities to start exploring and that just aren't out there at this point.
I would love to get into that. I mean, right now my brain is just like, I got there. My buddy Jerry, I know my buddy Jerry, he's going to hear this podcast and be like, let's do it.
I know you're like, thinking, okay,
let's figure this out.
Like, let's rebuild it. So, but, you know, obviously to do that, you have to find athletes that are willing to go with you down that journey. And that's again, another level of trust that you create. But, I think there's like, you know, when I asked you if there was, you know, is there anything else out there to be done? You know, I knew that there wasn't, but I wanted to hear it from you that there's so much.
There's so much. Yeah.
There's so much out
there.
We're just
scratching the surface. Scratching the surface.
It's so cool. Chris, talking with you, obviously, as always, has been just a pure pleasure. And, it always is. I always walk away feeling smarter talking with you.
Thanks,
and I've got, you know, mad deep respect for what you do. And I've always felt that way. And I don't know if I can say it enough how much I respect what you do and think that you are just the cream of the crop in your craft. So, if people want to find out more about you, to get a hold of you, to try and book into you, which is sometimes harder than, you know, like getting into the dentist.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best way to get a hold of you or find you?
Bicycle Fit Guru, the website, bicyclefitguru.com. They can see the scheduling and stuff like that. Between January and October, I'm between 1 and 3 months out for appointments. And then, but now, like November, December, I'm pretty slow.
So get in now and do it.
Yeah, get in now. And then you can be ready to train and to ride in the position that you are fit. Instead of doing it in the spring, you know,
that's a good time to acclimate on the trainer inside or outside in the off season.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, Chris, great time. Super, super good learning here, and maybe be able to come back and kind of touch on some new things as we, in the future. I'd love to have you back on if you'd be open to that.
Anytime.
All right. Well, I thank you guys for listening today. Again, subscribe to us on iTunes, and if you have any comments, leave only good ones, because bad ones get shut out the door on the backside. No, just kidding. I do listen to everything. So until later, or until we see you again, just let's be better.